All right. Good afternoon. I am Julie Fedorchak. We're getting started here today on the an informal hearing on three cases. Excuse me. PU21-87, 2N-9, and 21-102. And I don't have any opening comments. My fellow commissioners Randy Crispin and Brian Crosses are here. Do you have any opening comments?
I do not.
Get over to you in a second here. Do you have any opening comments? Okay. So before we get going, this is an informal hearing involving only undisputed facts. If there are any disputed facts, we'll close the informal and issue a notice of hearing. So the applicant usually goes first in this type of proceeding. But before I start, our staff here, Adam Renfant, Victor Shook, we'll kick it over to the staff. But before I do that, I'm going to give it to you, Brian, if you want to make any introductory comments, then you can kick it off to Dave.
No, excuse me, I don't have any opening comments, just ready to take a look at the information and ask questions along the way.
Thank you, Dave. So with that, we have Dave Cedarquist here from XL Energy, and some other XL reps are on the line, so we'll let you run the show from your company's perspective. Thanks, Dave. You have to turn your mic up.
Thank you. First of all, I just want to thank the commission for scheduling this informal hearing. I guess we think the informal hearing process will keep this February event true process moving ahead, and we're going to do everything we can here this afternoon to address any concerns or questions that have come up since the last informal in early May. So we will address a little bit more specifically this issue of storage and if and how XL Energy might be able to make some adjustments in terms of its practices with storage. Rich is going to cover that. Rich Derryberry, who is our Director of Gas Supply and Planning. He's also going to talk a little bit about some of the fundamental differences between XL Energy and the other gas utilities serving the state of North Dakota to address some of the questions that I know Commissioner Crosh has had. So we'll talk about that. And then we're going to show a couple of slides that indicate sort of our historical cost of gas in North Dakota and what our average natural gas rates are. And we're going to show some other utilities on those charts from the upper Midwest and in North Dakota. And the reason why we're going to show those is because we think they demonstrate pretty well that the practices and the strategies that we're using to procure gas for our customers in North Dakota is pretty effective, pretty beneficial overall, and then the long term. So Lisa's going to cover some of that. And she's also going to then run through some additional true-up scenarios at the suggestion of staff. We've got some additional modeling here with some longer terms, 16 and 18 month terms, and also some changes in the seasonality piece there. So she'll talk about that. So that's kind of our plan for this afternoon. And before I hand it over to Rich, I'll just kind of ask if commissioners or staff have any comments or questions about what we're intending to talk about.
I think it looks good, Dave.
I think I'll hold off. I've got a couple additional questions. I think half a dozen of the questions I've had or so have been forwarded to you. Okay. I think, Victor, I think you sent them. And I'm just taking a look. I think the answers are probably embedded in the presentation. So
hope so.
But I've got a couple of follow-ups beyond that. So
I'm not distracted by a question that's lingering in my mind. If we are able to come to a consensus, and if we were to have a special meeting at some point coming up, is it possible to do something that sets forward the recovery process so that it could start in July, or is that ship sailed and now we're starting, we're talking about August?
I can take that, Commissioner. So our notice needs to run through June 28th. I've confirmed with Dave the company can implement, if we were to do a special meeting on June 29th, they would be able to implement for July 1st.
And remember, we also entertain the idea of doing interim rates that would start July 1st, and then we would, if there was a need for any adjustments after that with a different decision or whatever, we could do that. So either way, we should be moving forward with some sort of a rate increase in July 1st to start correct. Capturing some of these.
Yes, so that's the option, I think. So my hope for today is that we can get all three of you to a point of comfort with the company's gas purchasing strategies, and then once we kind of get to that point, work through which of the number of months we're passing this back to the company over, be it starting July or August, and then 14, 16th, and I think 18-month options that the company's come up with.
Thank you.
Okay, then I'll hand it off to Rich Derryberry, and he'll be followed up by Lisa Peterson, our regulatory manager. So go ahead, Rich.
Thank you, Dave, and good afternoon to the chair and the commissioners. Appreciate the opportunity to visit with you again on this subject. This is quite a complicated subject, so it's more than understandable that there would be a lot of questions, and we're happy to provide you all the information you need to analyze our proposal. So there are a couple of things that we wanted to focus on, and we can happy to answer any questions you have to. But as Dave mentioned, I wanted to start with a review of our underground storage, current and prospective. So just very quickly, just to set the table again, we hold firm storage on three pipelines currently, roughly 190,000 dekatherm withdrawal per day rights in February. That number can change depending on what month you're in. Underground storage is very important to us. It's a great benefit because it allows us to vary the quantities each day to meet the changing demand profile that we have from day to day. So just very simply, on a colder day, you pull more out. On a warmer day, you pull less out. So important varying tool for us, balancing tool for us. And also, the drawback to storage is our storage accounts need to be relatively empty by the end of the winter heating season. So for our particular services, that means 80 to 95% of the account has to be empty by the end of the winter. And that's a requirement of the underground geologic formation. You can't keep it pressured up all year long. Most of our storage is that way. So what that means in practice is we need to be steadily drawing down our storage account inventories over the winter as we go along. We can throw in some gas here and there occasionally for balancing purposes, but we need to be on a steady decline from the beginning of the winter to the end of the winter, which constrains us a little bit in what we can do. So underground storage is really then sort of our primary tool for serving these variable needs, these changing needs due to temperature and whatnot over the winter.
One quick question. So you have give a range there of 80 to 95% needs to be drawn out by the end of winter. Is the range there because some of the system has an 80% requirement and some has 95? Is that the reason for that?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay.
Thank you. One of the ANR services is 80%. The Northern Natural is 95%.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Dave, I think we can move on. Please feel free to ask questions as they come up.
Are you going to talk more about storage, or is that the
yes.
storage overview? Okay.
Yes, I have several slides on storage.
Oh, okay, I see. There are more to come. Okay, I'll wait.
Just whetting your appetite so far. So I shared this map with with you last time, I think a picture is really helpful here, and we'll spend some time on this map. But just to orient you again, Fargo and Grand Forks are at roughly 11 o'clock below the big Emerson triangle there. So that's our service areas. And this map in general shows you the large pipeline grid that we rely on to move gas from supply areas and from storage areas. And we'll go into a little more detail on this map in a second. But let me just point out to start where our existing storage is. So below Ventura, there in the middle of the map, along the pinkish line, a little more to the left. Yeah, that's our largest storage area on Northern Natural Gas. We also have storage accounts on two Michigan companies, two AMR pipeline companies, in Mitten, over there in the middle of Michigan State. And we can bring that gas down south through Chicago and around to our service areas, or up north on that light green line, up through the Great Lakes and over sort of west across the top of the United States. So that's how we access our storage today. So Dave, I'd like to stay on this map while I talk from the next slide, because I think it would be helpful if we could point out the facilities that we're talking about.
Okay.
So we regularly monitor the availability of storage in this part of the world and pipeline transportation. And unfortunately, this entire grid network that you're looking at is fully subscribed right now. So there's no available capacity, generally speaking, that we could acquire without the need for additional pipeline construction and expansion.
Okay. I do have one question regarding that. And I don't think it's on a future slide. You're talking in today's terms. And I actually went on the Northern Natural Gas site, went in, and got to a point where I could actually request storage. But got to another point, and it said that there wasn't any currently available. But over the past decade, have there been opportunities to acquire more storage from a Northern Natural Gas? Because I understand, okay, today it's fully subscribed, but were there opportunities over the past 10 years to acquire additional storage?
Northern had an expansion roughly 10, 15 years ago, which we participated in, where they did expand their network, their storage cavern, and we did participate in that. Since then, there's been very limited opportunities to do so. We've had one other change in our storage portfolio in Northern in the last 5 years, and that was really focused on our electric generation assets, where we adjusted the storage to make it a year-round storage service rather than a winter-only storage service. But Northern has not had a large-scale expansion in some time. It's very, very popular. Any capacity that would be released would be picked up by someone else immediately. This is part of my future presentation. Building a new storage cavern is very expensive, and there needs to be economies of scale to make it work from the economic standpoint from the pipeline company. You can't just go out and tweak storage, generally speaking. You can't add 25,000 a day. You need a large number, and you need a number of participating shippers to make the economics work. So I think that is why, although storage would be very popular on Northern Natural, I think that's why there haven't been additional storage expansion, because the demand hasn't been there to support the cost related to such a large expansion.
Another follow-up on that, is it hard to find locations for storage? Like, is there a limited number of geological resources that can do it?
Yeah, I'm not a geologist, but I'll speak by going for a second. There's no good underlying reservoirs in this part of the world from eastern North Dakota over to Michigan. I think that when the ice age came through, it scraped all of that stuff off the surface. and remove the possibility of oil gas development. One of the primary areas that you use to develop storage is depleted gas production fields. So places where there's been gas production for a long time is a good place for storage development. Bakken is a good place for storage development. But there's no real native oil and gas development in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, that part of the world. Michigan has some. They have a lot of production. They have a lot of storage. But where we sit, sort of in the middle of the upper Midwest, there's very little storage available and nothing that can be easily developed, to my knowledge.
Thank you.
I have one more question. One more real quick one. You had touched on storage for electric generation. What is the capacity of that storage versus the storage that you reserve for natural gas customers?
I don't have the number off the top of my head, but it's roughly the same range. It's in that same neighborhood quantity.
Okay. Thank you.
And that question.
If I could just digress for a bit, electric storage is used for something different than LDC storage. LDC storage is primarily used for cold winter days. Electric generation storage is needed. We're a part of MISO, so when MISO asks us to turn on a plant to generate power, we have to have the ability to introduce a lot of gas into the system very quickly. So storage for electric generation purposes is really designed not as a temperature reactive thing, but as the ability to turn a plant off and on during the day as MISO dispatches them.
So, Rich, would you provide that statistic when at a later time when you can firm it up, what the volume of your electric generation storage is compared to your other, and then also, what those numbers looked like 10 years ago?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? My volume dropped down. I apologize.
When you're able to look those up later on after this informal, would you provide us with the amount of electric generation gas storage you have? And the amount for other like home heating, and then also what those two numbers looked like 10 years ago.
Yes, I can do that.
I have a question that I think specifically what I need or would like to know, and you can explain this to me because maybe I'm missing something. You said that you went from having seasonal storage on the electric side, correct? And I forget the terms you use, from winter storage to year-round storage, or maybe it was summer storage to year-round.
Yes, sir. It was winter to more of a year-round usage.
How did you find that capacity? Because it seems like, or was that open capacity?
We converted some of our existing generation storage capacity to the seasonal storage.
Is that just change how you draw from, but you're still leasing the space 12 months out of the year?
Yes.
And
still
you
all the space 12 months out of the year. It just allows us to use it flexibly throughout the year rather than having to fill it in the summer, empty it in the winter.
Okay. And prior to that, it was still a 12-month agreement for that 190-ish thousand on the electric side?
Well, I'm mixing apples and oranges a little bit. The LDC storage capacity, 190,000 withdrawal, that hasn't changed. The generation storage, those are separate contracts accounted for separately. So it's part of that generation storage we converted from a year-round, winter-only to a year-round type of service.
And when did that occur again?
5+ years ago.
Okay, could that have gone?
I can get you the year to be helpful.
Could that have gone to the home heating side instead?
Generation is fully used on generation. Generation doesn't generally have spare capacity.
Okay. Pat Fawn has a question.
Pat Fawn from staff. Could you also tell us was the LDC gas storage and the electric generation storage, was all that acquired at the same time? Or were they acquired at different times?
It's been acquired at different times over the years. We've built up the storage portfolio over some period of time, over 20, 30 plus years.
So when was the electric generation storage acquired, and when did you determine that you needed that storage?
I don't have that year off the top of my head. I think we were using storage for both assets as early as 2007 and possibly earlier. Again, I can give you the years if it would be helpful.
Sure.
Okay, good questions. Anything else on this before I move on a little bit? Okay, so looking at the map, so we've talked a lot about Northern Natural. So Northern is fully supplied. It would be very expensive to for them to add more. In terms of other available storage options, we could look at WBI storage, which is, looking back at the map we have here, WBI storage is roughly speaking over on the western side, the western border of North Dakota. So there is some storage over there. We would transport it through that blue line due east to Fargo. That last segment of line there, the last third of eastern North Dakota, that line is solely dedicated to us now. Unfortunately, it's a rather small line. It's 8,000 decatherms a day running into West Fargo. That line is fully subscribed. If we wanted to add any more capacity coming into Fargo from that direction, it would require WBI to reinforce that line. And because it's such a small line, they're probably going to have to build another line and lay it in a wider trench where the existing line is. So construction and costs. And then another way that we could potentially access that same storage on WBI is to come through the Northern Border Pipeline, which is that blue line, right? Yep, that blue line right there. We could introduce storage into that line, go all the way down to Ventura, down 4 o'clock, and then back up northern back to our service areas. Again, though, the northern border line is completely full and would require construction to have more service. And then shifting to Michigan, where we have our other storage services, once again, we're faced with limited access. We could take mid-Michigan storage, move it on those red lines, which is AR pipeline, sorry, through Chicago. And at Chicago, we have the choice of going north on ANR and then about mid-Wisconsin going west on Viking to get to our areas. Or if we stayed in Chicago, we could stay on the blue northern border line and backhaul into Ventura. Both of those are full, too. We have been talking to ANR about costs for those things, but once again, not inexpensive to build. We can also access some storage from Great Lakes Transmission, which is the green line that runs across the top of the map. So due north out of Michigan, and you take a left at the Great Lakes and head west. But once again, the ability to move out of storage there is fully subscribed as well. And then finally, the pinkish line that connects directly to Fargo and Grand Forks and runs over to Wisconsin and up to Emerson, that is IPS transmission. It too is full and fully subscribed and require construction. So these are all pipelines that we have contracts with and work with regularly. So we have regular conversations with them about availability and the possibility of expansion. And we know that all of these are fully subscribed and would require expansion dollars on our part.
Is the North Bakken expansion?
Does it go far enough to help us?
Where does that? I should know this, but does that tie into the Viking line? Or will it tie into the Viking line? And there aren't any opportunities to get low-priced Bakken gas via the northern or the North Bakken expansion over to the Viking, then into Grand Forks?
Well, I believe we might be mixing terms. I think the project name that WBI used for that project was the Valley Line expansion, which did connect that line that runs east-west that we were pointing out earlier. It does connect that line to Viking.
No,
And that was constructed a couple of years ago. That doesn't interconnect with us, but it does connect WBI and Viking.
No, I'm talking about the one that was just approved by FERC a couple of days ago, the North Bakken expansion pipeline. That's what the one I'm talking about.
Okay. That one is a production area to northern border project. It doesn't connect to our service areas.
Okay. All right.
It increases the ability to pull gas out of the ground, but it doesn't increase the capacity on the northern border. So it doesn't increase transportation capacity. It just gives you more choices for where you buy gas from.
Okay, but it's a purchasing option then, or no?
Well, we could buy the gas, but there's no ability to transport it with all of the takeaway pipes being full.
Yeah, well, I mean, I could ask a lot of questions. I'm talking about switching contracts or having a more attractively priced offering, but.
Yeah, that gas, unfortunately, just isn't well connected to our part of the world, infrastructure-wise.
Okay.
You would have to increase the capacity of that WBI line to Fargo. Or you'd have to increase the capacity of the northern border line down to Ventura for us to be able to get that gas.
All right, thanks.
We'd love to have it. It's just very expensive to get it.
One follow-up question. Where you're talking about going, in some of these cases, even though there isn't capacity on the line, you've talked about going on, say, the Viking line and hauling gas west, and on some of these lines, like, or going west and north on the northern border line, the line doesn't run that way, does it? Does the gas flow? Can you go in the opposite direction if you want to?
The gas flow in the northern border line is west to east to Chicago, but we actually have a contract today where we can move gas on a displacement basis from Chicago back to Ventura. So the gas doesn't physically flow that direction, but there's a displacement transaction where the gas is delivered at Ventura on a physical basis on our behalf in displacement of gas that someone else receives in Chicago. And we could, that is an expansion opportunity that we're looking at right now, actually, to see if we can do more of that on an economic basis.
So you just, can you talk about that a little bit more just so I understand it? Because I'm visualizing the gas traveling on the pipeline, but it isn't. You're buying it one place and somebody else is selling it at a different place?
Well, as I said, this is a complicated business. So, yes, the molecules are physically flowing from Bakken through Ventura to Chicago. So that line is roughly a 3 BCF line. So we can say we want 5,000 decatherms out of that line. We would enter into a contract and cause the facilities to be constructed to allow this to happen. But we could enter a contract for 5,000 a day, where our receipt point is Chicago and our delivery point is Ventura. And as long as Northern Border has adequate flow on between those two points, they can simply swap out our delivery for someone else's. So you can do that. You can do that any day on an interruptible basis, meaning it'll work if the system allows it to, but there's no guarantee that it'll work. The contract that we have today with ANR, with Northern Border, is a firm contract. So we actually paid them to install some compression facilities west of Chicago that would push that gas to Ventura if needed. So if there was ever a time where they could not do a physical flow displacement like I described, where there was no gas in the pipe for some reason, they could still physically move the gas back west to Ventura if they had to. So that then, in my mind, becomes a firm contract because they can do that guaranteed 365 days a year. So that is an expansion opportunity for us to see if we can do more of that economically and access storage because of that. I realize that's a strange concept. Did I do it justice, or should I try again?
No. That's fine for now.
This is Victor with staff. Let me give it one quick shot to simplify it a little bit. I think the long and the short of it is, let's say Chicago is buying gas from Northern Border out of the Bakken. They don't really care how far it travels along that line as long as the gas shows up in Chicago. So what I think I'm hearing them say is NSP is going to take some of that gas that was destined for Chicago out at Ventura and replace it right before it gets into Chicago. And Chicago is, they know about this transaction. It's not like it's a surprise to them, but it ultimately gets them what they had purchased.
Replace it with how?
From one of those other lines.
Okay.
And the Nexus, is it?
Yeah, there's several lines in the Chicago. There's actually a nice liquid hub at Chicago. So there's a number of lines that you can buy gas out of there.
I got
and
it.
And replace it.
Okay. Thank you.
The gas business, you know, it seems to be kind of old and stodgy, but it actually can be kind of flexible and creative sometimes.
Yeah.
So then the point then of this map is really all of the current infrastructure grid is sold out. And so there's no easy way to increase storage access to our areas. Let's skip down two slides now.
Rich, what generally prevents further build out? You'd think something like this, that when the capacity's gone, someone would be building more. Is it just the financials of it, or is it the issues of siting and such as that to get pipelines built?
Yep, another very good question. The federal regulation of pipelines is somewhat different in terms of cost regulation than the state regulated world. In the federal world, pipelines are only reimbursed for their costs when they have a contract. And they're only allowed by FERC to build more capacity when they have a contract. So they can't simply say, well, I think the market's going to need another 50,000 dekatherms in a couple of years, so I'm going to build that. In the LDC world, you know, that is what we do. You know, Fargo's growing. We need to build more capacity today so that the homes that are going to be built in 2 or 3 years, or the businesses that want to turn on in 2 or 3 years, will have gas immediately available. So very different construct in the federal world. They only build when a customer shows up with a checkbook. Literally, they do not build, and FERC will not let them build on spec. So in answer to your question, it's a matter of paying customers. Whenever they get enough paying customers to sign firm contracts, they'll build. Now, the problem is kind of like in the utility world, too, there's a big sense of scale in these projects. So if you just have one customer show up and all he wants is 5,000 a day, that project is probably never going to work economically. So you need a large scope. You need a number of customers, you know, willing to pay firm to make the quantity large enough that you can get a cost that people can live with.
So generally, that's
the driver. When you have enough customers willing to pay, it happens.
Are there any companies out there right now that you're aware of that are doing open seasons where you or others could sign on to allow them to get to that point where they have contracts enough to justify new construction?
Well, Northern Natural has an open season right now for transportation, not for storage. We are talking to another company in this area, another pipeline company, is working on developing an open season. I don't think I can name them right
That's
now.
Okay.
I think it's probably confidential. But yes, there's a possibility in the works. We've actually done one expansion across Viking, across AR and Viking, that will add about 30,000 a day from Chicago to potential service to our North Dakota points. That is pending FERC action right now and is scheduled for in service in the fall of 22, I believe. So okay. Yes, there are pipelines out there looking at these things. I think right now at this moment there's only one that's public that I know of.
Okay, thank you.
So then let's talk about some possibilities for expanding storage. And my primary goal here is to let you see how this would work and some of the potential costs involved. So let me start by saying that now our North Dakota customers pay us about $8 million a year in transportation and storage demand charges. So those are the payments that we pay to the pipeline and to the storage provider to ensure that we have firm service. Demand charges are paid every day, whether you use them or not, but it assures you that you will always have that service when you need it. So you tend for transportation, for example, you hold transportation service on a firm basis for your expected peak days, not for your shortest days of the year. And now a caveat before I get into some of the details. It's devilishly tricky to predict how much a storage field will cost to develop and what the rates will ultimately be. You're going into, generally speaking, you're going into an underground depleted gas reservoir where a producer has pulled out most of the gas. You're trying to figure out what the boundaries of that reservoir are and how quickly you can inject withdraw gas. And whether the integrity of the field will allow you to do that year after year after year. So these projects tend to take 3 to 5 years to get to in service. There can be contentious because of landowner issues, the people on top of the storage field and producers and others that are adjacent to the boundaries of the storage field. So, challenging projects, they're certainly doable, there have been plenty that have been done, but they're challenging. But it's very difficult for me today to guess what that cost would be because it's very situationally specific to each pipeline. But as I said earlier, we are regularly surveying our market for transportation and storage opportunities as they come up. So we've had conversations with a number of pipelines and developers over the years. So what I've done here is I've taken information we've received from these people in the past for unrelated projects and tried to apply those assumptions to this project. So please do not consider this filed testimony. This is an accurate number. This is more a directional notion of what the number might cost to help you see how we evaluate these things. So having said that with those caveats, if we look at Michigan, if you recall, when we were looking at Michigan, there's a lot of good storage fields in Michigan. We could probably access through available capacity without additional storage construction, probably 50% of NSP's design day needs without extensive storage development. So we took that number, assuming we could acquire that capacity. We applied tariff transportation rates to get to our areas. and assumed away the possibility that there might be higher construction-related costs. However, you know, we're just looking at the map and talking about that displacement ability from Chicago to Ventura. That won't be a tariff rate. That'll be a higher rate. So the number I'm showing you here, if anything, is probably a little low. But if we go through that scenario, we're probably talking about something in the neighborhood of $21 million a year in additional demand charges to all of our customers. So in a substantial number. And unfortunately, given the what we believe is the amount of available storage capacity that we can acquire without construction, that's probably only going to get you to about 50% of the gas we were purchasing over President's Day. So if the intention is to say that we will never have a President's Day again, you know, this only gets you about 50% of the way there. If you want to go higher than that, then pretty much everything along the transaction chain is going to require construction, storage field, one or two transportation systems, and the costs go way up from there. So that gives you a sense of the neighborhood we're talking about if we're talking about Michigan. So that's the bad side of the coin. So flipping to WBI storage, which in terms of as the crow flies is probably the closest storage field to us. Unfortunately, we don't have good connectivity with the transportation grid. But looking at WBI, and if we're reading their website correctly today, we think we could acquire 28,000 dekatherms a day of storage capacity. And then we would require WBI to expand that line that I was pointing out that goes due east into Fargo to serve that additional 28,000 a day. So it's going to quadruple the size of the existing. So we're estimating that that's probably about an $8 million a year incremental increase in demand charge. So, you know, double what we're charging our customers today. And unfortunately, again, we have the same problem that 28,000 is really only about 50% of what we were dealing with on President's Day. And if we go above that 50% threshold, then we're talking about storage expansion, which is very expensive, very time-consuming, and more uncertain.
I have a couple questions. One is probably a little easier. Are there opportunities, Canadian opportunities for storage? Because you know, I think I'm guilty of being fixated on what's available in the U.S., but obviously Canadian gas is coming down from Emerson, serving Grand Forks, Fargo off the Viking line, et cetera. Are there Canadian opportunities?
None that are close. I think you have to go all the way to the other side of Canada. TransCanada is, I guess I'm exposing my Americanism here, but TransCanada can be difficult to deal with. We're happy to buy gas at the border. But the regulatory structure in TransCanada, transportation rates can really bop around a lot in TransCanada. So it makes it difficult to do long-term planning because the rates you thought you had can change from rate case to rate case and be quite dramatic. So long story short, I don't think there are good options for us on TransCanada.
Okay, here's the second question. As promised, probably not as easy. The way you have this, you know, the picture you're painting is expanding storage would come with risk, challenges, cost, and basically it seems like you're painting a picture that it's not economical to do so. NSP is sitting at 25% on storage. But another utility that we're currently evaluating is at 50% on storage. And they're making it work from an economic standpoint. So I'm just trying to reconcile with with the admission that I don't understand this segment of the gas market terribly well. But it doesn't. It seems like, okay, it can be done, and it's been done economically, but the picture you're painting is that it can't be done economically. Is it just higher storage transportation costs as you roll to the east versus west, proximity to the fields, et cetera?
Thanks for asking that question. I mean, I'm glad you're letting me know what you're puzzling over. So there's some differences there. That utility has the great good fortune to be sitting in the middle of a production basin, a very prolific production basin, quite close to a accessible storage field. So for them, it's easy to access that field, and it's quite economic. So I don't want to second guess my utility brethren, but it probably makes sense for their cost structure to be able to do that, because they were able to do it without the need to build transportation pipelines, for example. We unfortunately aren't in the middle of a production basin, and it's a long way to supply for us. So we're faced with these cost constraints that they don't have. And I can tell you, one of our other business units is in Colorado, and we have the good fortune in Colorado of sitting in the middle of a production base. And, it's not fair, but it is much easier when you're right next to the supply. Your services are much more flexible. They are much cheaper because you don't have to pay to transport them over long distances. So those customers have the good fortune of being near a production basin and having cheaper energy costs. So, more power to them. Unfortunately, we don't have that option. And I guess I would say one other thing, not trying to second guess how they do their business operations, but storage costs are, storage is wonderful to have. It provides you flexibility to go up and down to balance your loads and whatnot. But it is a cost you pay every day of the year, 365. And it can add up. And there is a right level. There is a correct level for storage. And if you hold too much storage, then your customers' rates are higher. And I think that Ms. Peterson has a slide later that shows that we compare very well rate-wise to our utility brethren in the neighborhood. So there's a choice you have to make about how much you want to charge your customers for storage. Now, on a horrible day like President's Day weekend, having a lot of storage is great because it does help you avoid some of these costs. But remember, you're paying those costs every day, every year, even when you don't have a bad event. If you have a warm winter and you don't need that much storage, you're still paying those costs. So you need to look at the whole year rather than just the one event. I guess I would say that. Now, would we like more storage? Yeah, I could use some more storage if I could find a way to do it in a way that it didn't hurt my customers financially. But a big part of that is they have the great fortune of being in the middle of a production basin, and we do not.
Okay. And not to get ahead of the pricing slide, but just something to keep in mind is an alternative, realizing that there are restrictions on storage, as you're explaining, to enter into different to secure gas in a different manner, to contract more at the beginning of the month, et cetera. And we can get into that when, because I don't see a lot in terms of slides, and I think that was one of the questions that had been sent, but just something when it comes to that point in time. I think you said there's another person explaining that. That will be one of my first questions. Are you locking into rates when they're low?
I can address that, too. We may as well do it now. So I think the question is, can we do more baseload purchases, meaning gas that's purchased in the summer or the fall for the winter. And what you do when you do baseload purchases is you say, this is the minimum amount I think I'm going to burn every day in December, every day in January, every day in February. You want to tie it to the minimum amount, because if you say, I'm going to buy the maximum amount I expect to burn, then 25, 28 days out of that month, you're going to have a lot of extra gas that you don't burn.
Right.
And what do you do with it?
Yep. No, understood.
Okay. So the question then is, can we do more baseload? And we're looking at that right now, actually. I think our opportunities to increase the baseload amount significantly are very limited. I think the costs will go up dramatically if you do that. There's just a lot of variability in weather. In February, we had this really cold event, but outside of that cold event, demand was like a third of what it was over President's Day weekend. So if you're going to buy a firm quantity that never changes day to day throughout the month, you have to aim for the warmer weather, not the higher weather. And the whole winter was like that, actually. Everyone is going to remember the President's Day event, but December and January were quite warm. And actually, less than a week after the President's Day event, the prices were normal, and it was hot again. It was a warm spell. It was too warm for February. So if you try to buy gas, baseload gas, for more than these warm days, you're going to end up awash in gas, and there's going to be a lot of costs that your customers don't want, that you don't want having to deal with, you know, that extra gas. So we're looking at that. You know, we'll make sure that our assumptions are correct there, and that we're challenging ourselves. But at this point, I don't see that we can make a significant difference using that theory.
Say, Rich, a couple other questions here. I know Randy has one too. This is just a quick one. Did you guys, back when MDU had an open season a number of years ago for a new gas line from the Bakken over to the Viking, were you guys, did you subscribe to that? It didn't get enough customers, but do you recall if you guys were one of the subscribers?
We talked to them at length about it, and that is actually how I derived my $8 million number here for the WBI storage exchange. We talked to them a great deal, but the cost of the project, we just couldn't justify the transportation component of it for what our needs were. It's the cost of the transportation alone was triple sort of the average cost that we pay for transportation gas. And we just didn't feel like we could justify the expansion at that time with those dollars.
Okay, thank you. Randy has a question.
Well, I just want to point out that we're two-thirds of the way through our allotted time, and we're on page 6 of 16, and we've entirely talked about storage and transportation options for the future, which really don't have to be decided today. But it seems to me the recovery for the December event, the timing of it and the amount of it, does need to be decided today if we're going to take advantage of July. And so I don't know if anyone has something set in stone that we have to end this at 3, or if we can go till 5 or 6, but we're a long ways from getting to what we need to do today.
And I have to leave at 10 too, so I'll have to step out early.
10 to
3.
Well, I'll remind everyone that the reason we're having an informal today, I was pushing toward a formal and wanted to see if, and it wasn't about the recovery mechanism, it wasn't about the length of time, excuse me, it was about first verifying that it's a valid number to base those decisions off of. That's where I was, and I said, okay, I'm willing to try the informal approach, talk to staff, versus going to hearing. So I'm not at the point of, that's why I'm asking the questions, to support how it's been, the gas purchases, the gas storage strategy, making sure something wasn't missed, because when we get into the cost of gas, which we will, and you get a, you know, just to be honest and candid, when I look at a Great Plains natural gas serving Wahpeton with exposure of, it looks like it's going to be about a third less in terms of pricing impact because of the cold weather event, how did they make it work? For a third less versus the number that we're talking about, and I realize there are more providers. It's a different mix. I understand that, but it's to me it's a logical question that I need verified in my mind.
Well, I think we just have to keep plowing through. So, yep. To the extent that you can, we aren't suggesting not asking the questions, but if we can maybe tighten up the answers a little bit, that would be helpful, speed things along.
Actually, my next slide, I think, is in response to that question, and then I think I can hand it over to Ms. Peterson.
Okay, thanks, Rich.
So when you compare us to our utility brethren in North Dakota, it appears that we may not fare as well over present state weekends others. So why might that be the case? So one thing I would point out is that geographic variability of the weather. When you look at one of the presentations made by one of our fellow utilities in their informal, when you look at when their load spiked, it was a number of days before present state weekend. So I infer from that it was colder in the middle part of North Dakota before it was coldest in Fargo. And that's not an unusual weather pattern at all. I see that quite a lot. It's not unusual for Fargo's coldest day to be Monday, Minneapolis' coldest day to be Tuesday, Chicago's to be Wednesday. So not an unexpected pattern. But for that utility, they were buying most of their gas on the open market on days where the prices had not spiked yet. So that allows them to avoid a lot of cost exposure, simply because the weather was kinder to them than it was to us. We unfortunately had the cold weather hit over President's Day weekend when it was affecting a great majority of the United States, pushing up demand and unfortunately losing supply, causing the price spike. So timing was against us on that. We also had a challenge in that the way the gas market works, you buy all of your gas for the weekend on Friday. The market doesn't trade very effectively on the weekend. There's very little supply offered. So on the worst time of the event, we were buying gas for Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. So that, I think, influenced prices upward as well. And then I mentioned already the benefit to having additional storage capacity on a day like that. Also reminding you that, you know, there are everyday costs that you experience because of that. And then there's a couple of small utilities that serve some of our North Dakota folks too. Those are very small utilities. The smallest utility purchases about 30 decatherms a day, which is, frankly, that's meter error on one of our meters. The larger utility is about 2,000 a day, if I'm reading their findings correctly. So 2,000 a day is 0.3 thousandths of a percent of what our big days are. Now, I mentioned earlier, I think, that the standard supply package you purchase is 5,000 decatherms a day. That's what everybody defaults to. So both of these utilities are not standard. They have non-standard pricing packages. So they had to make a special deal with the supplier to get these kinds of small quantities. And I think what they've done is they've gone to a third party to provide them supply. We manage our own supply and move our own supply. I think because of their size, they're paying someone else to do it. And I suspect that what they've done is they've bought packages under fixed price arrangements where the price of the gas doesn't vary. Now, they can do that because it's a non-standard deal and they're very small us being a larger utility with larger purchasing needs, we would not be able to replicate that kind of deal. But they're probably paying a higher fixed price. Their fixed price is probably higher on a daily basis than the prices that we are experiencing. But when you have an extreme event like this, that fixed price probably helps them for the, you know, the 30 decatherms they were purchasing or the 500 decatherms they were purchasing. But because of our scope and scale, you know, we can do better than that every day. But I think it probably did help them that they probably had a fixed price for a very small part of their swing on those days. And you know, just to say again, this is sort of rounding error for most producer, purchaser, or marketer types. You know, this is really sort of accounting more than it is, oh, I'm going to go buy 50 decatherms for my customer. This is just part of the package of the portfolio he already holds that day. So I think that's why they seem to do better. I mean, it's a benefit of them being so small, I think, in this case.
I would have to think, though, that at the same time that when they're that small, they're not getting the volume discounts that a much larger entity should be getting when you're purchasing gas.
Well, I think you'll find when Ms. Peterson pulls up the slide that their customer rates are higher than ours. So I suspect that they probably are paying slightly higher prices than us on a daily basis.
Okay, are we ready for the next presenter? Lisa?
Let's move on to the cost of gas slide, Lisa. Are you there?
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I will be brief. I realize we are short on time here. I just wanted to note on this slide that, as Richard noted, for the February gas event, our ranking against other North Dakota utilities wasn't as favorable as it could have been or as we would have wanted it to be. But we do believe that our gas procurement strategy has been working well overall, as we have been providing lower rates and bills to our customers over the years compared to other utilities. XL in North Dakota, our residential cost of gas rates are shown in the blue bar, or I'm sorry, in the blue line. On the graph. This graph indicates that our cost of gas rates have been consistently lower than other utilities over the last 5+ years. And we can go on to the next slide. This slide shows that XL North Dakota customers have experienced the lowest average all-in natural gas rates of investor-owned utilities in our region. This data is from 2019, the most currently available data from the American Gas Association website. We have ranked well in rate and bill comparisons historically as well. We only show 2019 here for simplicity.
When do the 2020 statistics come out? Because when I'm looking at the previous slide, the blue line is Excel. You were above Dakota Natural Gas. You were above, well, probably it balances out about even with Great Plains. So I would expect 2019 is, you know, a snapshot in time, but 2020 might tell a different story.
Yes, as far as I am aware, the 2019 statistics on the American Gas Association website are dated October of 2020, so I suspect they would come out in late summer or fall if their recent past is any indication.
Do you know where AGA gets the figures?
I believe utilities self-report.
Okay.
And I think we can move on to the next slide. Moving into the February event, here we provide some recovery scenario impacts that are updated from the last time we spoke. The blue bar is the 14-month, 50% seasonal rate proposal that we showed in our May 18th filing. Here we also take a look at the recovery starting August 1st with 14, 16, and 18-month recovery timeframes. If you look at the largest month, the largest impacts are in January. The green bar is the 14-month, 25% seasonal rate, which shows about a $28 impact. The length of the recovery time to 16 months, this reduces the January impact by about $4.60 on average, and an additional $3.60 of reduction if we move the recovery time off to 18 months. And I also wanted to point out that, as you can see, the 25% seasonal rate structure does have a bump up in those shoulder months of October and April. That's because there are still some pretty significant usage in those months on average, and that usage is now being multiplied by the larger summer rate. And so you compare to the winter rates that also have high usage, you're going to see an increase in the bill impact in those 2 months. The next three slides show very similar information for the commercial and interruptible classes. For the commercial firm class, the blue bar is the 14-month, 50% seasonal rate proposal that we showed in our May 18 filing. And then we also show scenarios with recovery starting August 1st again for 14, 16, and 18-month recovery timeframes, this time using a non-seasonal rate structure. Again, orienting to January, the green bar is 14-month recovery at about $320 per bill as a bill impact. And then as you lengthen that recovery time to 16 months, it reduces it by about $45, and with an additional $60 if recovery moves to 18 months. Moving on to the next slide, I show similar information for the small interruptible class. The blue bar is the proposal we showed in our May 18th filing. And then we also show 14, 16, and 18-month recovery time frames starting in August. And the January impact is about $1,200. And then as you lengthen the recovery time to 16 months, you reduce that by about $175, and then an additional $150 if you go to 18 months. And last but not least, in terms of the recovery scenarios, so this is large interruptible. In January, the 14-month recovery scenario is in green, shows about $8,200 of bill impact. Lengthening the recovery time reduces that by $1,200 if you go to 16 months, and an additional $1,000 if you go to an 18-month recovery time. And then last, I wanted to point out that we recognize that lengthening the recovery time frame can bring some confusion as we start to overlap with different true-up years. And, we would start doing that September of 2022. And I consider that it might be helpful to display true-up factors for the February event separately in our monthly cost of gas filing. Today, the cost of gas true-up is displayed in the section shown on this slide at the bottom of Schedule A, page 2 of our cost of gas filing. We would propose to add the highlighted line to this schedule in order to cut down on confusion around what true-up factors are in play in any given month. Customers wouldn't see this displayed any differently. They simply see the total cost of gas rate on their bills, where the true-up factors would be rolled up into that. So there would be no change for a customer bill. And that's all I had today, but I am available for any questions you have.
Okay. So I do have one question. Can you give the seasonal? Well, Victor, you might. Are these seasonally adjusted?
Which one are you? Would
Let's go to the residential. I guess they're all.
Yep.
Along the same lines. Well, let's. So.
Sure. So
the therm rate in June, for example, or July versus January. What are those numbers again?
I guess I'm not sure what the specific rate would be per therm, but certainly this is the seasonal optionality. So the blue line would be a kind of a more lightened seasonal approach. So the winter rate would be half of the summer rate versus the green, yellow, and pink bars. The winter rate would be one quarter of the summer rate.
Oh, give me the colors again.
Blue is 50%.
That's a 50%, right.
Yep. Okay. And then the other three are a quarter.
And the only thing that I would add to that is that we stayed with a seasonal rate for residential. We changed it to a 25% rate after talking to staff. For the other classes, we moved to a, or I should say for the commercial class, we moved to a non-seasonal rate, so the same volumetric rate all of the months that are shown here, except the blue bars that was a previous proposal of ours. And then the interruptible classes, we had originally proposed non-seasonal rates and continue to show non-seasonal rates on these graphs.
Is that because you kind of found some the customer usage in those other classes doesn't quite lend itself as good as the residential class to a seasonal factor?
I would say the seasonal average usage pattern is the most seasonal of all of the classes. There is some seasonality certainly shown in the commercial and the small interruptible. I think that we do have some anecdotal evidence after talking to some of our account managers that for some of our customers, our commercial customers who don't have a seasonal pattern, getting hit with a true-up rate that is, you know, four times bigger in the summer than the winter, kind of if they're used to getting a little bit more of a flat flat bill, they seem to indicate that that would be less preferred. So the anecdotal customer element, as well as the less seasonal usage pattern, was the reason that we started looking at non-seasonal rates for the non-residentials.
Sort of.
And I'm sorry. I was just going to say, Commissioner, I think our position on these is that all of these are reasonable options, that we're not necessarily favoring one way or another. So we're just trying to show some relative impacts and where we can be ready to implement any one of them.
So this is Victor again. So just to kind of simplify a little bit what I think I heard you say, for every other class but residential, you could be unfairly burdening particular customers by doing a seasonal true-up rate for those classes.
Correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
That's what I was looking for, and I would tend to agree with your assessment of the different classes in such a way. So thank you for that.
And I'll say I had not thought about that in advance, but that is a good point that makes sense. So.
I also just wanted to confirm that what I heard previously, that we would be ready and available to implement one of these scenarios or something that's we've previously discussed July 1st if the decision was made on by June 29th to do so. Just wanted to confirm that.
I continue to feel like I did before. I mean, this has been good information, especially the earlier information about possibilities going forward. Maybe things that should have been done, like, you know, I don't know, if one more company signing on and getting on board might have made that MDU line a reality one time or something like that, but they didn't. And in the present, with what we have to work with, I do not support going beyond the 14 months. I can see pros and cons with the 25% or the 50% seasonal adjustment. And so I think I'm pretty flexible between those two, but I do, you know, when I look at getting out into October of 2022, or especially the thought of getting out into January of 2023, we could very well have something this bigger to deal with next winter that in those months we will need to be building in. And, you know, I just think that going beyond 14 months is putting off too much of the inevitable and potentially making a much bigger problem than the one that we face now.
Well, for the purposes, excuse me, I have a cough that just doesn't want to quite exit the scene, but I think for the purposes of the informal, it's about getting, receiving the presentation, which we have, seeing the different scenarios, and the company now has stated that these are just different scenarios for the commission to consider. You don't have strong feelings in terms of the direction that we ultimately go. So I think, yeah, I've got some thoughts on it as well. I'm concerned with 14 months, and I don't want to get too far into it because it's almost becoming an ad hoc work session in terms of starting to, and Commissioner Fedorchuk's not in the room either. So, you know, ultimately, though, a big factor for me is what's the impact, especially to a low-income household, and understanding that whether it's 14, 16, 18 months, they're going to have to pay the same amount and make up for the price spike. That isn't likely to escape anyone in terms of the process itself, but these are meaningful amounts in some of the tough months. You can't, you know, when it's 100 degrees, conceivably you're not going to open up the windows, right, and let the air go through your house in July. But you might keep the windows closed. And the house will finally get to a point where maybe late in the day you can control it far better than you can when it's 30 below. You just don't have the same flexibility. So that's the challenge in all of this, and one of the reasons why I like pushing it out just a little more before we get into the next. I'm probably not that excited about 18 months, to be honest. I think when I was visiting with Victor, I was in that 15 or 16 month range, just to spread it a little bit more. So, but I think it would be, yeah, to be fair, we might have to convene a work session just amongst the commissioners and staff to hash this out. Not that we can't talk about or, you know, express thoughts. There's nothing wrong with that. So we're probably not that far apart in the whole scheme of things. But we had the schedule till 3 o'clock. Is that correct?
Correct. If I might just cover a couple of points on timing and things like that. So 14-month schedule starting July of 2021 makes the recovery of this be over with by the time of the next true-up, normal true-up period. So the recovery is done, and whatever residual amount would get rolled into the next true-up period of a normal 12 months. If we don't start this until August rather than July, a standard 14 months is going to take us 1 month into the next recovery period, and mm-hmm. Likewise 16 months into, you know, 2 and 3 months. I'm not saying we can't do those kind of things. I just want, for clarity's purposes, kind of to specify what we'd be looking at.
Yeah. Well, that's a great unknown. What will the next true-up be? Will it be a positive or a negative in terms of how customers are impacted? We don't know. We could speculate on what the next cycle is going to look like. And frankly, there's so many dynamics at play. And on one hand, I would have to believe all utilities purchasing gas are, even without prompting from a commission, are taking a really hard look at, can we do better? How can we better protect ratepayers? That's, you know, I truly believe utilities across the country are doing that right now. So there could be some benefit, and I wouldn't want to use the term dusting off the strategy, because I think it's reviewed constantly. But taking a deeper dive and taking an even deeper inspection usually produces better results. So I'm optimistic that we'll see some, maybe not huge, but incremental improvements in terms of that. The hard part, it's something, because gas prices are constantly moving. Ratepayers never know it. They don't know that, well, it could have been this if we hadn't, you know, done whatever it is. But Victor, do you have something
I have
else?
One other piece I'd just like to cover real quick, and that's the third case we noticed for this meeting is case 2187. This is a refund from Northern Natural Gas that NSP received earlier this year. Normally, that would go into the cost of cost adjustment. At that time, it was immediately before the cold weather event in February happened, so NSP had proposed applying approximately $500,000, that is North Dakota's share of that refund, against the Fargo manufactured gas plant cleanup, which made sense at the time. We haven't taken action on that case other than to issue a notice of opportunity for hearing. I think I've mentioned to the company and to the commissioners the idea of using that $500,000 to help offset this under recovery. And I guess I'd just be kind of looking for some direction if the commission would like the company to do that and withdraw this application for the alternative treatment, or if they would prefer that it stays on its current course and goes towards the Fargo gas plant cleanup.
I personally, the direction I would give personally is that due to the sequence of events and what occurred, to have it applied to help, even though it's not a huge amount in the whole scheme of things, to help mitigate the impact of the February event directly.
Sure.
And mitigate. That would be where I'm at. I guess you knew that, but just to... Sure. You had actually brought it up, pointed it out, and I agreed. I thought that was it. I like the approach.
In the next rate case, we will set something for that, correct?
Provided
the gas plant.
So at this point, the company received deferred accounting treatment for the Fargo gas plant cleanup. So the commission hasn't necessarily approved recovery of that, just that the company can start tracking the costs. So in the next rate case, it is permissible that the commission could grant recovery of that over some time period. Traditionally, I think, is about 10 years is what we've done in other cases. If memory serving, I don't know, that case was a while back, so.
I think we used 8 years in the Grand Forks cleanup, a much smaller amount, but.
Well, I probably didn't anticipate that it was going to be this long in deferred accounting when we did that. I don't like when things like that draw on so long and the people who wanted to do something don't pay, and then later on people who never had any stake in it end up paying the bill for it. But that is what it is. So I expect we'll be addressing that soon. And in this case, I don't feel real strongly which it gets applied to. I think we did the right thing with the TCGA and applying that money to that gas plant, so there is some skin in the game for current customers with the decisions that were pushed for. And I think that this is kind of okay applied in either of these instances. And this actually, if it's applied to this cost of gas case, would get the customers to the people who benefited from the gas being available in February the most closely, so I'm fine with it.
Certainly. One other piece on that Fargo gas plant cleanup. I'm not sure if the companies would have be prepared even today to be final with those numbers. I think they're still waiting on some insurance settlements to play themselves out, so there's the potential for that to not quite be ready next year or so even, I guess. But absolutely agree with everything else.
Yeah, and I will say that the cost of that cleanup has already been substantially reduced by the legal proceedings, as well as we have been amortizing those expenses since 2018 as well. So we have already effectively expensed part of that as part of the settlement. So I think the news will be good when we firm up the numbers.
Good.
Okay. I'll be wrapping up since Commissioner Fedorchuk exited. But before, and she had another commitment, and we were scheduled till 3, so understandable. With that in mind, Commissioner Christman, do you have any other questions that you'd like to ask?
I do not, thank you, though.
Staff, do you have anything? I'll have a couple of questions that I'll send as a request, and then everyone will see it when the information does come in. One of them will be just to help me when I'm looking at the February, I believe it is the February cost of gas filing. And I don't think it's a question you'll be, well, if you could answer it real quickly, otherwise we can just do it through through an email request or an information request. I'm having trouble reconciling when I get into Schedule B, page 2 of 10, the storage. And the storage numbers listed, the volume per day, exceed the 190,000 decatherms. I think I'm coming in right at around 240, 230, 240, and yet the number that it's been used quite often is there's 190,000 decatherms. That's the storage contract, unless that, and I understand the float, you know, where it's going to move around, but this is a February 2021 demand charge, you know, detail the spreadsheet. So just a heads up on that, and I think it's probably more complicated than getting a verbal answer, but it would be a request I'll officially make. Okay. Probably after the hearing through advocacy, or not advocacy, advisory.
Should we see if there's a quick answer to that?
If there is, that would...
I don't know, Lisa, is that something that we can, you'd rather follow up with, or?
I myself would need to follow up unless Richard has an answer off the cuff here. I do not.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'd rather double check the filing and not speculate. So
sounds good.
I'm happy to answer it, but let's go back and get it.
Okay, fair enough. And I assume that'd probably be the case. So. Didn't want to put anyone on the spot, but it's definitely worth asking. Okay, anything else the company would like to present? Okay, then prior to wrapping up, the handouts and the material, as well as the audio recording of this proceeding, are now considered evidence. Are there any objections to this evidence becoming part of the official record upon which a decision will be reached. Any objections from the company?
No.
Any objections from advisory?
No objection from staff.
Okay, thank you. Then this evidence as presented is now part of the official record upon which a decision will be made. Does anyone else have anything they would like to add at this point in time before we close the proceeding? Okay, seeing none, then this informal hearing is now closed. Thank you, everyone, for your time.
Thank you.